So our topic,
Is
are you going to go
okay.
around and
I'll go
introduce
start out.
people
Yeah.
first?
Okay. So welcome everybody to Berkeley Monastery. This class is called Buddhism for the Modern Mind, and what we have is we have two classes alternating. We have one class with Doug, and the second week we have a discussion around more around practice in terms of how to apply some of the principles we were learning through one of the very major philosophers of Buddhism, Nagarjuna Bodhisattva. But this evening is the one where we really try to think through a topic with a much more kind of a contemporary edge to it. So, yeah, go on. And so tonight's topic isn't karma just fate? Is karma just fate? And because I think in America, in the West, karma actually has actually come to its own in America. And oftentimes what it actually means is fate. It's basically, that's just your karma, so deal with it. It's just kind of comes with the territory. So what we're trying to do is actually unpack that concept a little bit. And also this class actually has been in a series, maybe the seventh class in the series. So we've gone through quite a bit of material, but usually Doug reviews a lot of that before, and I see a lot of new people here today, so I'm sure we'll go over quite a bit.
So this question that we have tonight starts for all of you with what is your theory of causation? So one of the major identities, I hope I can just start without having to explain myself too much
Wait, wait,
here.
wait, 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 one more thing. So
Stop.
just to give people some context. So if you haven't been exposed to Doug before,
Just stop
he when he talks, he goes in outer space very quickly. So if you have any questions or don't understand what he's saying, don't feel bad to ask him because most of us don't understand what he's saying most of
No, you do, you do. But I
the
just so this question tonight, the question of fate is really a question of causation. In other words, what your theory of causation is. And one of the major aspects of your identity that each of you have is a system of causation that you're using. Does anybody understand what I'm talking about so far? In other words, all of you have either you probably have several theories of causation, none of which work real well, but you try them out all the time. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. Are we good so far? And these theories started very young. Like one of the first things that you do in the development of your identity is come up with a theory of causation, starting very young. And this, if this happens and this, if I do this, and then there's this in between the causal construct you have. So obviously, another aspect of this causal thing has to do with temporality and time. So let's just, for a theoretical construct tonight, start with that the present moment that we're talking about is the conduit from the past to the future. That's just a theory, but as a theory. So what we want to zero in on is, I would say that the past is determinate and the future is indeterminate, passing through the present. Okay, are we good so far? So the issue that we want to talk about tonight is what the nature of the present is. If we want to look at the question of fate, or we want to look at the question of karma, the question is really is what is happening in the present? I'm simplifying a lot of things here. Is there, just to get us into a kind of focus. What is the present? What's the nature of the present in terms of our present consciousness? What's the nature of that? How much freedom does it have? So one of the main themes of the class so far has been freedom, because one of the major focuses of, from a Buddhist perspective, one of the key elements that you're working on developing is a kind of freedom of conscious awareness that you're developing, that you can observe with, that you can look at, that you can observe with this freedom of conscious awareness. So freedom of conscious awareness, though, how much freedom does it have? And what is it, how much present, how does the present work for each of you in creating the future from your past? So what I want to just go around and ask people, maybe you can share a little bit about what your theories are, your personal theories about causation that you're using. Not that are theoretical, but that you actually use. Are you using, like, for instance, although people might say they're scientifically orientated, I doubt whether you actually use a scientific theory other than for those 5% of aspects in your life that relate to a scientific context. Is everybody following me? The rest of the time, even though you might say I'm really grounded in a scientific approach, would all of you agree that that approach only covers that which we can commonly agree is measurable. I mean, can we limit the idea that we're, so if we're going to use a scientific construct, we've already agreed that it has measurability, common measurability to it, and therefore we'd have to determine how much of our existence has that common measurability. Because as soon as we're talking, like, for instance, an emotion or a relationship between us that related to anything that didn't have a real clear measurability to it, then we'd have a difficulty talking about it scientifically. Whatever. Are we good so far? So most of you would use a scientific frame possibly to look at causation, but everyone agrees that there's a limitation to that frame, to a very specific frame of reference, so to speak. But are we good so far? Does somebody want to say that no scientific frame works to everything, and I'm a complete scientism person that believes that ultimately everything can be explained from a scientific frame of reference, meaning that there would ultimately be some level of measurability to the actual causal, not in retrospect, because remember, we're not talking about going backwards to determine what happened in time, but rather what's actually happening in the present that determines the future. And we all understand that science has almost nothing to say about that present, right? It can go backward. Science is very good at looking backwards into the determinants of the present. And how does science protect itself in this place? By the concept of chance, right? I mean, everybody understands that it uses probability and chance to protect itself from being to being radically causal. Are we good so far?
What do you mean has nothing to say to the present?
The science is talking about is always talking about an explanation of the past.
Okay.
And it's very effective because it says what it is about the past that I'm going to talk about is number one, measurable and commonly measurable. And then I'm going to tell you what happened in the present based upon the past. I can't tell you what happened in the future in a deterministic way because there's always the question of probability, even to the areas that I might scientifically investigate, let alone the 95% of human existence that doesn't even lend itself to that kind of measurability. And you understand that every time you put from a Buddhist point of view, everything is actually causal, absolutely. So there's no out of chance. And so Buddhism would say, if you don't understand what it is that's happening causally, it's simply because you don't have a wide enough frame of reference to causation. Okay, I mean, just are we? I know we went far fast, but is every so. What's your so? I think it would be good to get a little sense. I'm just throwing some stuff out there to begin to see what does people have some ideas of causation that they use and questions they have about their system of causation they're using that can introduce us to the issue tonight from your personal experience. Does anybody have any?
What do you say? Do you want to ask a question?
Does anybody have any? Does your causal system work 100% of the time?
One thing I found is like, it's amazing that you say something, you might not even think it's that big of a deal, but that has a rippling effect and it changes like huge parts of your life.
How you think it, what you think.
Yeah.
Okay. Thinking is one element of causation. Now remember, thinking is extremely abstract though, right? Everyone understands that any thought we have is already the past, already condensed. It's already interpreted. A thought is already the past in the present, right? All thought is the past in the present, already condensed as a representation, and it isn't even what actually happened. It's an internal theory about what happened that we're now currently applying to the present moment. That's called a thought, right? Are we good?
So then what would you say happens when you think about future things? How would that
When you
help?
think about future things, well, when you're thinking about future things, you're projecting ahead of yourself into your possibilities. But whether those possibilities that you're projecting into will actually occur causally is not known. The future is mostly fantasy. And as you've all found, the system of causation that you're using right now, projecting into the past, I mean into the future, works better the more you've limited the possibilities, and there's and works less well when you have a greater openness of possibilities. Is everybody fine? So I mean, you see, so as we have a total openness to possibilities, if we see the future as a total openness to possibilities, then any causal construct will work less well than if you've limited the system of probabilities that you've limited the possibilities of your future to certain kinds of frames of reference, right?
That's called controlling.
Well, that's the way most of us control our situation, is we limit our freedom, radically limit our freedom in order to try to create, to make our causal system work that's totally inadequate. You might repeat that again?
Yeah.
Okay, does everybody understand that? What we basically are doing is we very frantically from a fairly early age start limiting our freedom as quickly as possible. Why are we limiting our freedom? In order to get in control of what our sense of ourselves is, especially in terms of our projection into the future. And whatever causal system, since the causal system we're using that we feel like we have control over existence through our causal construct, works better with limited possibilities. You could actually say you're limiting your freedom to make your causal system work.
Can you?
That's irony. Now we're going to get into some good, real irony here, right? So as everybody, we're frantically trying to limit our freedom to make our causal system work.
Can you get an example of that? I mean, a more concrete.
Well, everything, all relationships, all jobs, everything, every ideology, every identity is radically trying to limit our freedom. Right? We're trying to limit our future freedom by limiting our identity to a very small scale of possibilities in who we think we are, the theory we have about ourselves, the way we're projecting ourselves into the world. So these are all limited very quickly, not because we don't have an infinite amount of possible freedom, but because we limit them simply because of the insecurity and the anxiety that we would feel by actually being open to the absolute freedom of our conscious awareness, which is actually, from a Buddhist point of view, absolutely infinitely free in space and time. So from a Buddhist point of view, the conscious awareness that you're using to pay attention to me right now is infinite in space and time, has no boundaries to the consciousness, and has no, and is in the infinite present. It's never not in the present, it's always in the infinite present. So there's no boundaries to the consciousness. The boundaries are what you add through your habituation to that, through the theoretical constructs, ideologies, and identities that you take on out of anxiety, fear, whatever that you have, that you've been spending all your time working on developing, your fears, anxieties, desires, and so forth. And so out of those, you then construct kind of ideologies of yourself or theories about yourself or identities about yourself that also have a causal construct that goes along with them that then tries to make everything work out, or at least be explained through your causal construct.
Can you explain another causal construct?
There's all kinds. Anything that one thing causes another. So if you say the reason why... you know, like one causal construct that we came up from a psychoanalytic construct is that the reason that you act in the way you do is because you're driven by desire, by some fundamentally instinctual desire, some kind of primordial desire. And everything is either a repression or a release of that desire. I'm just using one very well-known psychoanalytic construct. And so the causation is always partly unconscious and only a little bit conscious, because what's actually driving it is these unconscious forces of eros and so forth that are driving it. So therefore, there's a deterministic construct where the conscious awareness of the present moment is actually, from a psychoanalytic point of view, is somewhat illusory. In other words, from that point of view, the freedom of the individual consciousness in the moment is somewhat illusory, because you can't tell what's happening on an unconscious level, let alone on a conscious level, of the drive of those desires in every activity as they project on every single object and person and in your environment, and you're constantly projecting from this desire on everything around you. It's, okay, I'm just giving one real well-known one that you may or may not buy into or not. You have political ones. Like there's really big political ideologies that are based on economic theoretical constructs. There are political correct, you know, we have many in Berkeley, we have a really good batch of political correct ones. So we have ideological theories that have the cause of something happening in the other. So in the current political correct world, we're frantically looking for what to give up our freedom to not being free because the other is causing us to do something, or we don't have freedom because the other is taking our power. I'm a woman, I'm this, I'm blah, and then I don't have the power within myself and my consciousness, but I don't have my power as a theoretical concept because someone else has taken my power from me. And then I'm going to get it back through what? Them giving my power back to me. But then you've already lost your power because you're waiting for them to when are they, as Nietzsche pointed out, if you're waiting for someone else to change before you're empowered, then you're in the slave relationship to the master, no matter what the actual political or economic construct is. Is anybody following me so far? Okay, so from a Hegelian, Nietzschean kind of view, and into the kind of modern critical theory and so forth, the only way that you can take back, so to speak, take back control of the freedom of your conscious awareness would be to recognize the introjection of the social limitations that you've taken into yourself and are now you've taken them in a way that you're actually limiting your own identity through the introjection of the social identity that you've taken in and now limiting yourself with. That's been around for like 30, 40. That's a major kind of critique of post-critical critique, okay? And so then, but the problem is then we're constantly looking for the other, what other it is that's to blame for me not having my freedom. So there's another, I mean, we could come up with many, many different theories. I don't know what theory you're, but if you look at them, they're all theories, no matter what they are, no matter what theory, is giving away the freedom of your conscious awareness in the present moment in terms of the infinity of the future, because whatever theoretical construct you're using to see it through is already limiting the potential way you would see the freedom both in the present and the future, no matter what theory. Is everybody... Are we good so far? That's sort of what we're talking about. I just want to get, we're just doing the preamble. But, okay, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Okay. This is just prologue, right? So is everybody good so far?
Sure,
everybody
same.
Would see what I'm, everybody knows what I'm talking about first. So does everybody see it in themselves? Does everybody begin to look at their own theory? Did you all see your own theoretical construct, that your causal construct that you're using? How successful has it been? How successful it hasn't been? Are you trying to force the environment to fit your causal construct? Are you limiting the possibilities of your experience to making your causal construct work? Which way are you trying to give up your freedom as fast as you can? You know, which method are you using to try to give up your freedom as fast as you can? So does everybody understand my question to you individually in your own process? I mean, this is not abstract. I hope nobody thinks, although it sounded abstract, I hope nobody took what I said to be abstract. I hope you can see it in yourself what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about something abstract. I'm talking about exactly where you exist with yourself. This is the least abstract thing.
They're not mutually exclusive. I mean, I do both.
Which both?
I try to force my environment to fit mine.
You
and
do both.
My relationship
plus
with others,
many
and
other
I live
things.
In my own.
Plus many other things. I only mentioned those two. There's many other things we're doing at the same time. They're not only not mutually exclusive, we haven't even started to list the different kinds of things that, I mean, I've only suggested a few ways. that we construct this. And I've already, there's a multitude of other ways that we could talk about what we've talked about so far in terms of the construction of this. And they're definitely not mutually exclusive. In fact, one of the problems each of us have is in the modern world is that we have a whole bunch of these cells going on that are in contradiction to each other. If we were only dealing with a single construct and then trying to negotiate a world with that single construct, we'd be in pretty fundamentalist good shape. That was a little ironic, but okay. But unfortunately here in Berkeley particularly, one of the things that we, you know, probably most people here are live around this area, have some sense of enjoying, is that we are mostly very complicated in a multitude of identities and ideologies that are fighting with each other within ourselves. And we're actually, we're more having problems with the problems of all the different aspects of the approaches that we're taking that we can, that is very, and that we're applying to different things, but then working to, and we find ourselves to be very inconsistent. And I would say we're all probably very hypocritical. We're very hypocritical and it's not a negative. We're not hypocritical because we're trying to be. We're hypocritical because we're so complicated in the different approaches that we're taking without a clear way to determine which one. Now remember, it wasn't very long ago that the system of causation that you were using was prescribed to a large degree from the culture you lived in. And your role, your gender role, all these things were prescribed within that construct. And then that kind of blew up and exploded, and now we have a multitude of different constructs. But the problem is nobody knows how to make a decision between one and the other. What gives one more authenticity over the other? How would we say this particular ideology or construct or causal construct that we're using works better than another one? On what ground? On what authority? And now we have the problem, not only on what authority we say, no, it's on my authority, but the problem is, which me? Oh, my authority? But which me? Which of the different elements am I using to ground and making a decision between the different elements of what I would make that decision on? On what grounds would I make that decision? Are we good so far? We're all in the same place, more or less? Would we all agree that we're a little bit in the anxiety of that ambiguity, that we're all in a little bit in the anxiety of that ambiguity as a kind of common state in here? Or not? I mean, is everybody nodding their heads? Yeah, okay, we can identify with. What's that?
What's the ambiguity?
The ambiguity of not being absolutely certain which element of my internal process of identity or whatever I'm most in accord with, and how I would decide between the different voices, my interior voices between them, what I might use as an interior voice. How would I decide the credibility of one voice over another? So then I kind of ask the question, what would you, so I've asked the question about four steps removed, like on what basis would you make that decision? What's that?
Whether or not it works.
And that, so we're saying pragmatic, right?
Yeah.
But when you say what works, how would you, when you say what works, how would you know what's worked?
Whatever's going to be most of what I want to do, I guess.
That's going to let you do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Would everybody agree? So then the question is, what do you want to do?
Okay.
So, no, I mean, what do you really want to do?
Do you want me to answer that?
Well, I mean, do you see that? The next question and going, we'll ask you that. But, I mean, does everybody understand that then the question is, what do we really want to do? The question is, where does the we really want to do come from? And what is that we want to do? So what do we really want to do?
Do we take joy out of it, what we do?
We could say joy, but now we've got another marker, right? So would everybody agree that if what they do gives them joy, that would be a good marker? No, yes.
For what you want.
What's that?
For a definition of what you want.
Well, now we've gone another step, because we've actually talked about the marker of, he's saying, well, it is what I want. But then how would you know that what you want is what you really want? What marker do you use that what you want is what you really want? Right? Because you want a lot of things, but what's the marker of that what you really want is satisfying or not, or what? Or what, on what grounds would you say? Because we're talking causally here, so this is pretty critical, because when you say, I'm going to use what I really want as my causal construct, but is it really what I want as the causal construct, or the result of it in terms of like emotion, or the result of it in pleasure, or the result of it, is it not the pleasure rather than the wanting? And doesn't it break down when you want something that's not as pleasurable as what you thought it was? You know, I'm just going down the road here. So if we say it's what we want, isn't it really not so much necessarily what we want, but the result of the wanting, the emotional or whatever, emotional thinking experience of what we want? Yeah? No? Is it based on the pleasure? Is it based on the pleasure of what you want, or what would people say?
Hello. Based on past pleasure.
It's what?
Memory of past pleasure.
Okay, that's what we base the present on, based on the past, right? So when you say you want something, the wanting's based on the past, on a past experience. That's the past and the present. The wanting's the past and the present. Based on past experience, I want this because it gave me certain kind of satisfaction that I think I can repeat in the future and the present. Would everybody, are we good? Would everybody agree with that? So we're saying then that the present and what we want is fated. Is fated. To use, it's already the past and the present. What we want is the past and the present. Mm-hmm. Is the activity of the past and the present, right? Is there, everybody's, that's what want, aspect of want is the activity in the present. We're faced with a present situation, or we're imagining a situation, and we go, I want this. That's the past and the present.
I have a problem with that. To a certain degree, yes, but not absolute. Because if that is the situation, then we can always predict what you're going to be and what others going to be, depends on your past.
We can't predict anything of the future.
Well, if that is what we base on.
No, we can't. Because remember, we can't predict anything from that. Remember,
If I'm able to learn something from the past.
Yeah.
If my behavior, my prediction, my behavior is solely based on what I learned from my parents.
Right.
Then somebody from outside can look in and can project what I'm going to behave.
Yeah.
From
and
my
I,
parents.
And I would
but
say,
I'm not.
Well, oh yeah. Well,
not,
oh yeah.
Not,
no, we're going to have to find a mechanism, anyway. Though. I'm not disagreeing that it might not be true, but the mechanism that we're talking about of want. Okay, remember, we're just talking about one mechanism as a theory right now. We're not talking about every possibility. But if want, if we're basing it on the mechanism of want, as you all know, although what you've all said might be true for you, that the wants, the past, and the present, you all in this room know that it's not very predictable. Okay, nobody, we haven't even talked about, we haven't even raised the question in this class so far, or in this discussion, of using want in the present, whether it works in predicting the future. Because everybody in here has had many experiences where the want in the present, based on the past, did not create a future that you would have predicted from that want from the past, right? Can everyone find at least one experience?
Yeah. After Dan said that experience, actually, my thought just popped right away. All the search engine right now online is totally based on that. They find out the keyword you have ever typing in your computer.
Yeah.
They come up with all the shopping lists. You don't even want, but it's there. And just keep running nonstop 24 hours.
Well, that's why eventually, if you use that theory, if we use this theory, you can see it does run their search engines. And there's a whole question of whether consciousness would even exist. But I'm going to leave to another discussion of the great future that we all have with when consciousness doesn't need to exist, because productivity and movement of digits called money and computers doesn't have anything to do with people, because it depends on the values that you're exchanging around these digits that make any difference. So let's not even go there yet, though. That's only about 15 years. I'd say it's about 15 years. The intelligence of computers will supersede the productivity of human mind fairly soon. So if that's your value concept you're applying, and these digits called money are moving from computers, they're just digits and computers anyway, then why would humans end up with any of them, you know? Anyway, leaving that alone for the moment. So is it a very good system? Is wanting it, I mean, the system that we're talking about right now, has it worked for you very well, the past and the future as want, as what has been able to give you information about the future? No? No?
Isn't this question a kind of moot question if there's no viable alternative?
But we haven't said there's not a viable alternative. We're just taking one theory. Certainly, that's not the only viable theory, but it's the one many people are using right now. I'm exploring what many people are using as their theory right now. There's many alternatives to this. Let's make sure we've run this one, that we're all in agreement that this has its shortcomings before we move on to other possibilities.
But is precog really what I'm trying, or what anyone's trying to get out of wanting something?
Is what?
Precognition. Like you said, like, is it helping you know anything about what's going to happen? It's like, well, I don't think that's really the aim of wanting.
Precognition? I don't
understanding.
Know.
Understanding. Being able to project what's going to happen in the future.
That's saying, what you add. The end of
saying
the
knowing.
Knowing what's going to happen in the future, we haven't established whether that's important or not. Okay. I mean, that hasn't been, so far we haven't like looked into precognition of that, whether that's something we can do or whether it's valuable or it's useful or anything. I mean, so far we've only looked at whether the theories that people are using in terms of want as being what's in the present, want being what's the past, whether that works very well. If people agree it doesn't work very well, then we could look at some alternatives. But that is a theory that a lot of people are using, right? Why doesn't that work? Why doesn't that, for you guys, why hasn't that particular theory that you've been maybe applying unconsciously not work for you in your personal experience?
Many variables to juggle. I mean, you have to think about long term, short term, what to even measure, like, because there's a lot of different kind of feedback mechanisms you can have, right? Like, is it just getting a little bit of that? Let's say I get a tub of ice cream, right? Like, is it the joy, the measurement of that sugar rush, or is it like just enjoying from the memory from the childhood of that ice cream? Or is it actually like, you know, the regret of like eating a tub of ice cream? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different factors at play.
The energy of desire is completely inconsistent. I mean, it might be there at one moment and then it's gone in the next. So what do you do with that?
The energy of the one. Mm-hmm. So we've got, people see other problems with it than the one, people are beginning to kind of look at the problems with it. Do people see some other problems with it in their own process?
I mean, usually the memory is incomplete and emphasizes only certain aspects.
Okay, so it's also bullshitting yourself usually. So it's mostly not exactly what actually happened, but oftentimes it's actually romanticizing what happened. So even the memory you're using as the happiness might not even be what actually was. So that would be an additional level of problem, because it's not even for sure that what you're using in the criteria there is actually something that actually happened in the way you actually even felt it, let alone that you could duplicate it. So there's a multitude. I mean, I think we could go through and see that there's a lot of different multitude of problems with that approach. Well, what other approaches are people using? Does anybody have another approach that they're using other than I want this?
Lowered expectation.
Lowered expectation. Now that's the super modern approach to this has been lowered expectations. Has everybody noticed this? That one of the approaches to having not for sure a very good system of causal application of things is to lower your expectations entirely of what you expect. So now in your relationship, for instance, particularly in relationships and in everything, there's lowered expectations, and that partially safeguards you emotionally from failure, right? And from a lack of achievement of things that you would have, so you give out a lot less to something. So the wanting, so a lack of expectations is another way of saying bringing down the energy of the wanting. Since I can't count on wanting, I'll bring down the level of expectations so that I actually have like almost no expectations at all. And then, of course, I could always be surprised with no expectations. Of course, the problem is when you bring everything down to no expectation, you have two people relating to each other with no expectations. It's going to be hard to maintain that for longer than a few days or weeks, because sooner or later you're going to come across something that you have to have a common value and communication about. And since you have no expectations, how can you expect anything of the other person? And how can you expect anything out of yourself? And then how can they expect anything out of you without territorializing your space? So then how do you relate? Have you found that to be right? It is an answer, but it's not an answer to long-term long-term anything. It gets you through the night. It's a good thing for hooking up on Saturday night, but beyond hooking up on Saturday night, it has a low degree of causal usage. As long as you're in a constant hooking up, it works pretty good, because then since there's no expectations, you can sort of float through the space of that. So do people themselves seeing themselves as having less expectations based on a kind of defense mechanism or not? Some people are, no, yes. You don't have lower expectations.
At least not consciously. I think I might do the opposite.
So what's the opposite?
I think it's like what you were kind of describing. Originally, it's like, it was really, like, I know there's, like, multiple modes of causation, like, operating, but the easiest one for me to think of was, like, kind of, like, the power of positive thinking, and that, like, oh, like, I want this, so if I think about it enough, and I figure out, like, all the ways to get there, and I imagine myself doing it, then I can make that happen.
So you can make that happen with positive thinking. Mm-hmm. So that's another causal construct. Now, if you notice, you can see already people have different theories they're applying. That might not be your what. So has it worked fairly well?
Yes and no.
Okay, so yes or no. So, but it's worked enough to still be useful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worked enough to still be useful. We could use power, positive thinking kind of thing. We could use other,
I was going to say, I should have used this method more often, but this is, sometimes I look at this way, like good or bad is only relative. So I tend to say, if you, just look at it like Alan said, lower the expectation, I guess. Good or bad is only relative, because if you put that high mark of reference, mm-hmm. then you would enjoy it, or you put it at the stress on the bad, then it is really bad. It's relative, so you can tone that where you at, and it will be lesser of, I would say, suffering.
Suffering.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's another good marker, suffering. So we've been talking about one side of the thing. Let's talk about the other side of the, because basically everything's driven between two things. In terms of how are we judging stuff, does it lead to greater happiness or contentment or to greater suffering? If we're using our own internal, you know, like to the marker of what it is, we're using one or the other. We're using two basic references, liking or disliking or suffering or happiness or something like that. We use that as our kind of fundamental base. Now, we've already seen that the happiness might be momentary and so forth, but let's go to the suffering side. Does everybody use suffering as a marker too? When you suffer, are you really able to be sort of aware of your suffering? You guys are all pretty good at suffering. No, you're not too good at suffering. One of the things, as everybody knows, Buddhism starts with the first noble truth is that suffering, that the question of suffering is a really good marker to see how you're doing. But the problem with it is that you have to be really open and aware of it. Because if you're not aware of the suffering, if you rationalize or don't pay attention to suffering when it's arising, then you lose it as a marker to give you a marker, an internal marker of what you're doing. Suffering is a marker, but the problem with suffering is it's only a marker if you can pay attention to it and be mindful of it as it arises.
An example?
Well, what usually happens with suffering is when people have an experience where they're suffering, like, you know, whatever, you know, somebody asks somebody to go do something that they like to go to dinner with and they don't want to go out to dinner with them or something there. So they suffer being rejected, or they suffer an identity within themselves that. And that could be a lot of different kinds of suffering. It could be like the suffering of being rejected. It could be the suffering of reinforcing something in yourself before. It's the suffering of loss, the suffering we could get back to, you know, the suffering of loan, you know, might raise an issue. I mean, it could go into all that suffering, could have many different elements to it. Does everybody know what I mean? We could probably make 10 things that are going on in a person out of one moment of like rejection or something. But the moment of rejection, in the moment of rejection, the suffering that's occurring of it is really good information about something if you stay mindful and focused on it and what it's about. But if you cast off the suffering, if you're not willing to look at your own suffering, then you lose the evidence and information about it. So I would say that mindfulness, for instance, a lot of people are learning mindfulness. I would say that mindfulness is best thought of as being mindful of your causes and conditions of life. Where do you experience suffering in those causes and conditions in any way that you might experience it, and be able to hold that suffering long enough in your mind to learn something about what the arisal of it's about. What is the suffering from? So like, for instance, being rejected. We could use that as an example. Being rejected is about already having put up something that could be rejected. I mean, there already has to be you have to put up something in your mind, first of all, to be rejected, to having it been rejected. If you ask somebody, you know, to go do something and they don't want to do it, that isn't necessarily rejection. It could have been 10 or 15 different things that happened in that moment. To read it as rejection is already an interpretation that's feeding an interpretation that if you look at the suffering that occurred and go and follow your way back in the suffering of it, you'll find that the suffering is much more complicated than what the rejection is. It's much deeper. The actual knowledge that actually the suffering is giving you is a lot deeper than what it seems like at the rejection. But if you're afraid of the suffering and rejection, you then do not pay attention enough to where that suffering's emerging in your conscious awareness to get back to the place it's actually arising from. Does anybody understand what I'm saying? Does anybody see what I'm saying? Say it again. When the Buddha said that the first noble truth about suffering, what he was talking about was, first of all, let's go back a step. Let's go back a couple steps, because from a Buddhist perception on all this that we're talking about, there isn't an initial lacking that there's anything to be wanted for. The initial lacking is already an attachment. The lacking is something you have to learn, something that has to be a basis of your experience. It's not a given beginning state of conscious awareness. Lacking is not the basic state. Lacking is a state that emerges much later in the process of conscious awareness. And then desire is put on top of lacking as that which I want to fulfill the lacking. And then the wanting on the basis of desire, and then the objects of desire are filling the lacking, which is objects of desire that fill the lacking, that there was never any lacking to begin with to fulfill. And then the attaching to things, ideas, things, principles, and ideologies that you hold on to as a way to are like four steps removed from the original movement. So from a Buddhist point of view, there was no initial lacking whatsoever. So the point of, like, for instance, the first point of, from a Buddhist perspective, the first point is to recognize, to get back to and understand the fundamental state of consciousness within yourself, that there is no lacking that even is there to begin with. There's nothing lacking. You're total, complete, and contented within your own conscious awareness. You're totally free, contented, aware, blah, 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 blah. There's nothing lacking at all. Everything that happens from that point on. So when the desire emerges that you want, that is already habituated. So you've created a habit of past experiences that you now, and then that moves on to wanting something and attaching something. Now, to go back to our question of fate, the Buddha, from the Buddha's point of view, he was teaching that you have absolute freedom in the present, potentially. But the problem is that the power of the past is so great, which is called karma. Karma is simply the power of the past habits in the present. So it's basically what we're talking about to a large degree. We have the past pressing into the present all the time with emotions, thoughts, identities, theories, fears, and so forth. It's all pressing in the present. And the conscious awareness, which is actually completely free and boundless and has no lacking, that conscious awareness is constantly being taken over by the habituation of the past. Now, what the Buddha taught was, in each split second of existence, in each moment of conscious awareness, you actually miss that you make a choice. There's a conscious choice made in every experience, in every moment of experience, that goes towards the past and not in the freedom of the present. You don't catch that because the force of the past is so great. The power of the past is so great in all of its different manifestations, emotions, thoughts, ideologies, thoughts, identities, is so powerful that it constantly fills the present with the activity and the actual existential awareness of the present moment, the freedom and choice of the present moment is lost. The actual experience of that is lost to the power and force of the past. So it appears as though we're driven by forces and so forth, and that's true in the sense of not having develop the freedom of the present. So insofar as we haven't developed the freedom of the present and actually have a sense of where that choice is being made and understand the open, free space in which that choice is being made, insofar as we haven't developed that in our process, then the past is so powerful it just overwhelms the present every moment, and it appears as though we're constantly caught in a fate of the past, in a kind of journey. Now, it is true as long until we actually develop the freedom of the present moment in the way that we're talking about, that in fact we are driven by the past in every present moment. It's not because it's the way it is, it's just because it's such a powerful force that it takes over in every split second of experience. It's taking over the free space of the present. Okay, that's, you know, we're talking theoretically, because to actually gain that, like meditation, mindfulness, recitation, all the different elements of Buddhism are basically aimed at that, creating the freedom of the current moment of time in a way that you can see what's going on. That's mindfulness, see what's going on, and not be overwhelmed by the pressure and force of the past into the present in all of its different manifestations. Okay, is everybody? So all these different practices are aimed at trying to do that, but it's very hard to do. It's, you know, theoretically you can kind of see what I'm saying, but to actually be able to create that kind of freedom of mind in the present moment, that freedom of awareness in the present moment, requires a kind of discipline, a discipline of mind to begin to open up that space. I'm just using space as a metaphor here, sort of. Okay, is everybody fine so far? Yeah.
Clarifying question. So then karma is like basically like when desire sprouts in the mind through to the present moment and all the bounds of the past, like the bindings
right.
of the past from when like desire first sprouted and
right.
somehow lost our original consciousness.
Right. So karma is the habituation of the past and the present in all of its different manifestations. But there's different levels of it too. There's different, that karma is operating on us as individual thoughts, as emotions, as tendencies, so forth and so forth. Is there enough for people to, there's more coming that way?
Sure.
See if there's, okay, so,
20. Okay.
So this is some material for you to look at. It's from the Lankavatara Sutra. It's some different pages taken from, and then also a little piece of the sixth page right at the end. So let's go to page 245. It's a little bit further in there. We've read this before, but this explains in one paragraph what this process happens, okay? How this process sort of happens. So this is, the Lankavatara Sutra is a very, what would you call it? Very direct sutra to the conscious awareness mind without any, I would say it's a very secular sutra, in that it really goes directly to the mind all the time. So I'm just taking one paragraph here that will take us through. So this is an answer to the question, why do people give rise to projections? Because what are we talking about here? We're talking about projections of the mind. So what is karma? It's the habit of the projections of the mind, 245.
Okay.
Yeah. So people who are in, you know, that are trapped in this, so how does this happen? They let their thoughts wander amongst names and appearances of convention to which they are attached. So here's this first sentence is karma. So they let their thoughts wander amongst the names and appearances of convention what you've learned to be the way things are from the language, society, culture, conventions in which you exist. Names an appearance of convention to which they are attached, to what you've attached to at this point in time. And as they wander among the... Now, those of the past, what you have of the past, that's already in the present. So that's the karma of the past insofar as determining the present. The power you have is not over the past and the present, but your decision of how you react to it. You cannot change the past. Does everybody understand? There's nothing in your past you can change. But you can change the way in the present you react to what it is from the past that's arising. You can't even choose what's arising. So you say you want something, it won't work. Because as you all know, what's going to arise during the course of a day, a week, and a year is going to be stuff that most of it occurs even when you don't want it to. In fantasy, thought, walking down the road, blah, 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 just keeps popping up, popping up, popping up. And no matter how you try to control what's happening in the mind, it still is going to be out of your control most of the time. And the Buddha doesn't say you can control that at first. The Buddha says, what you can control is the way you react to what's arising in the mind. Is everybody fine? So you, as they wander around, this is you and your mind wandering around the multitude of shapes that appear, they fall prey to views of what? To views and longings. Now, I don't know if any of you have any longings. But you fall prey to views, meaning ideas and concepts that you're going to use to try to control things with. Views means your point of view, your theory that you're applying about yourself. I'm this, I'm that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, this is who I am, this is going to work. This life is going to work, I got this under control. Okay, that one, okay. And as they wander around the multitude, they fall prey to what? These views that they think and longing. Concerning the self, that there is some sort of identity that I'm having that's constant and not a complex set of different things going on. That there's a unified self. Longings concerning a self and what belongs to a self, what I've taken on as the attachments that I think I am now. And what do they become attached to? And they become attached to excelling, which means adding to that. What do they become attached to? Adding more to the self that's already what it is. You want to add more. They become attached to excelling. And once they are attached to this whole process we're talking about, then they are blinded by ignorance, meaning they can't see what's going on. You can't see what's going on in this process because you've lost the mind, the consciousness has lost its ability to see what's going on, and this gives rise to passion. Then I love this, I've got to do this, this is it. And once they are inflamed, the karma produced by desire, anger, and delusion accumulates. And on the basis of that, there's an accumulation of now on the top of that, there's this other accumulation of desire, anger, and as it accumulates, they become enveloped in their own projections, and they live within their own projections as though that was the totality of reality. They're lost in their own projections. The projections of the world, you become lost in your projections of the world and the people in the world and your experiences of the world as your own projections, which the current state of most people is they're lost totally in their projections of their experience. Confused to where those projections even emerge. So as they accumulate, they become enveloped in their own projections like silkworms in cocoons or submerged in boundless states of existence in the sea of birth and death, as if they were on a water wheel. And because of this confusion, they do not realize that their own existence is something they've just created as an illusion. That the existence that you are using as your way to come is something you've simply created theoretically and are currently trying to make work, but has no foundation under the habituation of your own experience, which was in turn just an endless set of theories that you've come up with over time based on your experience that now you've turned into whatever your current experience is. A mirage, a reflection on the moon and water, and without a self, there is no essential nature to it, what you're applying to it. There's no essential nature. Or what belongs to the self that is devoid of origin and is devoid of anything, devoid of origination, that it actually originated anywhere. And this self never originated anywhere than in the first experience. There's no first cause. Duration has no duration because it's always in the infinite present. Or cessation. It doesn't have either duration or cessation, or what characterizes or what is characterized. And that it arises from the projection of their own mind. It's all, everything that's arisen that's currently operating is a projection of your own mind. And not from a creator. There's no creator. There's no time in which it's happening. There's no thingness to it, quarks and electrons. There's no quarks and electrons that fundamentally, quarks and electrons are explanations of a way of talking about it from a kind of physical view or a supreme being. Thus do these confused people wander among the names. That means thoughts and appearances through which they think they're experiencing, the thoughts and experiences there. So that's one paragraph to explain sort of the step-by-step causal way in which that arises. So that's a lot of information in one paragraph. So this gives you... So that's an example of the of a paragraph out of the Lankavatara. Let's go, and the last page of it has another, and you can read, we're going to leave this to you to read more of and see what you think of the sections that we took out of here because we don't have a lot more time. We're taking another from the sixth patriarch here. I'm taking a page out of that. And it's the last two pages in a different print. So good and wise friends, the correct teaching is basically neither direct nor gradual. It is the people's dispositions that are sharp or dull. So people have different dispositions. Confused people who cultivate gradually and are more aware of a person who cultivates directly converge with each recognizes their original mind, each sees their original nature. In this, they are the same. So, goodwise, the teacher of ours is from the very inception has taken freedom from thought as its source, freedom from appearances as its essence, and freedom from clinging as its basis. So what is the grounds of this moment that we're talking about, this experience we're talking about? It's freedom from thought as its source, freedom from appearance as its essence, and freedom from clinging or holding on to or grasping onto. Because the problem is, every time you grasp onto something and attach to it is what actually creates the karmic concept. So you want something, then you grasp on or hold on to it. The collection of all those things you grasp onto is sort of the karmic history, the holding on to. So freedom from appearance means to be detached from appearance while in the midst of appearance. While you're in the midst of all the experiences of your day, you can be amongst those appearances yet free from them, meaning not have the habitual way of reacting to them from the past. You could be in appearances, but not be reacting to them in the same way that you would have from the past being in the present moment. Freedom from thought means detached from thought in the midst of thought. So while you're in the midst of thinking, you're actually detached from the identity with the thought while you're still having a thought. Now, this is really important because the only way to gain this kind of freedom is not to necessarily leave your cause and conditions, but learn how to, within the cause and condition you're existing, see how it's your habit of mind that's attaching you to them. It's your habit of mind. The wanting is a habit of mind. So the trick is to create a certain amount of distance of immediate reaction. If you could react to things in a different way, so you're not in your habitual reaction to them. Freedom from clinging is the basic nature of human beings. In this world of good and evil, beauty and ugliness, enemies and friends, even during times when one meets with insults, criticism, verbal attacks, and bullying, treat all of this as empty and harbor no thoughts either of delight or revenge. In each continuous moment of thought, do not dwell on the previous thoughts. Right? We get that from when we talk. In each moment, do not dwell on previous thoughts. If you think about the previous thoughts, the present thought, and take up future thoughts, then your thoughts will continue without cease, and this is bondage. If in each continuing moment of thought you do not cling to anything at all, you're completely free of clinging to anything at all in your mind. This is freedom from bondage. This is the meaning of not clinging. Not clinging is our basis. So the trick is to not attach to what's arising. What's arising is from the past. But clinging to it or feeling controlled by it or reacting to it, either with fear or desire, is continuing the past and the present. So the trick is to not continue the past and the present. Then you gain a certain amount of freedom from the power of it over the present. Good way to remain detached from all outward appearances is called freedom from forms. If you can stay detached from forms and appearances, then dharmas are essentially pure. This is the meaning of freedom from forms is the essence. Good and wise friends, when the mind remains undefiled within all sensory states, this is called freedom from thought. In your thoughts, you are always impassive and detached from sensory states. You do not rouse your mind over them. If, however, you do not think of anything at all, the 100 things, and completely eradicate thought until the last thought is entirely ceases, you will die and be reborn in some other place. You should not do this. You should not simply enter the mind and empty it of everything, because that isn't actually working through the karmic conditions. So this gives a little bit of these different pages, of which we don't have time to look through very much, will give you some stuff to kind of look through and see what you think about it. What I would suggest is that we read it, if people can read it, and when we come again after they've read it a little bit, they'll raise a lot of questions, and people might be able to the next time we get together, they can maybe raise some questions about what they've read in these a few pages of text here. Okay, I think we're at 9, so we want to make sure everybody can go do whatever they're going to do. Probably the evening just begun. It's only 9 o'clock. So. Any questions or comments before we leave in the next couple minutes?
Is the next class going on Monday?
Yes. So we'll have a class next week. Basically, what we'll do is we'll be going over, as I mentioned, another text called Nagarjuna Bodhisattva's Perfect on the Six Perfections. And people know that we're not familiar with the Six Perfections. They're called the Six Paramitas. And they talk about various Buddhist practices. What we're talking about is how you can free your mind. So the six in brief are giving, precepts, or you can say to kind of a disciplined life, disciplined ethical life. Third one is patience, which is really important. Fourth one is vigor, and then concentration, and then wisdom. So wisdom will be able to see things as they actually are from this kind of lens of emptiness. And so all of those work together in a way to help you practice. Like, for instance, if you were to try to cultivate this without any patience, you could easily go crazy. Because you see this emptiness, but then you have all your identities and your afflictions still, and you go crazy because you're trying to, you grab onto your closest addiction to reestablish your identity because you're not able to be patient in your mind yet. That makes sense.
It's true.
Yeah, it happens now. You start practicing, you'll find, wow, I've got so many addictions. And things come up that's just very strange. But it's but you have to have this process of transforming all those, that energy to something else. That's the whole process, so you can free your mind more and more. So next week we'll be going over that a little bit as a group. So.
And we're going into April and May, right? So we have about six more times.
Yeah.
Something like that?
I'm not sure.
May 20th is the end.
Yeah.
May 20th?
May
20th. So I'll do about three or four more, and then you guys will do three. So we have about 6 weeks total, right?
Yeah.
But everyone's welcome. We probably about 6 weeks, and every other week we'll do, I'll do a thing, and then they'll do a thing the other week. So
this time is April 7th. So April 14th we'll be doing it, and April 21st Doug will be doing it. That topic will be, am I missing out? That's the topic for the next one.
That's your favorite one.
Am I missing out?
We do have a question online about the one of the last passages. So Winnie Chow says, is this a metaphor that we die and be reborn in some other place? I don't know if time to
that
address
we die
that.
And what pity?
No, you mean when you're empty?
Yeah.
Meaning that you die and born in like a god, you're in the realm of the gods.
Okay.
Like in the twelve different levels of existence, emptiness is the realm of the gods. You could live in all of empty space, but you'd still have karma. I know this is a little esoteric, but if you actually achieve the empty mind, the totally empty mind, in that kind of way that we're talking about, then your mind would be empty, totally empty. But it wouldn't have actually necessarily transcended all the karmic conditions. So that's why it said empty within names and appearances, within the construct of your cause and conditions, not outside of your cause and conditions. What you're trying to do is empty, not as an artificial state of your mind, ultimately, but as an actual process of transforming the karmic conditions you've created. It's not just an artificial mind that's separate. That's just another drug. I mean, a lot of people can meditate as another drug. Mm-hmm. They're just going to emptiness as a drug. This is not emptiness as a drug. This is actually developing the conscious awareness in which you can transform the cause and conditions that you've created. That's an actual active transformation of all that you've created. It's not a passive mind. It's a very active, we're talking about a very super active conscious awareness where wisdom can be applied to see, constantly observing and seeing, and transforming and changing the conditions that you've already created within those conditions. So you're transforming the relationships you created, not by escaping into another relationship or escaping from relationships, but working them through within the constructs of relationships that you've created. So that at the end of the day, if you've actually transformed this, you don't enter the same kind of relationship again in the same ways if you've actually transformed that. If you haven't, you're just going through one relationship after another in the same construct. And an emptiness that simply empties the mind, like I'm going to sit and empty the mind for 2 hours a day of meditation, doesn't necessarily transform the cause and conditions that you enter the next relationship with. And you've seen many people, you might even know a lot of people that meditate a lot, and at the end of the day are the same person they basically were after all that meditation. Is that right? Because what they've been doing is sitting in empty space as an escape from their mind. They haven't been transforming the conscious awareness in the actual cause and conditions that you created. This is not something you can do. You have to actually work it through with what you've created. And if you work it through with what you've created, then at the end of it, you'll actually transform those conditions, cosmic conditions you've actually created. Does everybody see what the difference is? So So this is a very active, and mindfulness is not sitting in emptiness. Mindfulness is observing and watching what's creating suffering in yourself, what's creating suffering in other people. Not trying to escape the suffering, but recognize it, react to it, and change on the basis of it so that the next actions do not lead to the same suffering. And how do you know how you're doing? How many afflictions you have, how much suffering you have. If you're unaware of the suffering, there's no marker. Everybody wants to escape suffering. No, you don't want to escape suffering. You want to be aware of the suffering that is actually occurring so it leads you back to the cause. And if you can deal with the cause, you'll get rid of the suffering. You can't get rid of the suffering by getting rid of the suffering. There's no artificial way to get rid of it. You have to get rid of the cause within yourself of what created the conditions of created suffering, both in yourself and other people and your relationships with other people. And this leads you to being able to then listen to other people very carefully. If you don't have so many needs, wants, and desires, if you can get the mind kind of still, then you would for the first time be able to listen to other people very carefully and accord with their cause and conditions. And then if you start really listening and caring and paying attention to, you know, other people in that kind of way, all the dysfunction of your relationships will disappear because they were all just projections of your own needs and desires and wants that you were projecting in the space of the relationship. And of course, they're never going to act like what your projections are. Are you kidding me? They're just another person acting their own. You're going to project on them, they're going to act like, yeah, it works for as long as they're playing the game to play with your projections. And as soon as they're tired of playing the game of playing to your projections, and then the energy goes out of the relationship. No, the energy didn't go out of the relationship. The projection machine that was the relationship stopped working as a projection machine. Is everybody? The relationship wasn't there anyway. It was just a projection machine that was getting fed back and forth as a couple of demonic forces each other. As soon as one person gets tired of the projection machine, the thing collapses. Not because of the relationship, because there was no relationship. The only possible way of having a relationship is to quell your own projections to the degree that you would actually pay attention and listen to someone else. And in the listening, then you would begin to practice the giving, the gratitude, the giving, the other aspects of yourself that aren't just kind of the needy, grasping, bumming parts. And as you actually practice those with someone else, they would become your guru, so to speak, in your own process of transformation. So another person could certainly be your guru, but they can only be your guru if you actually get to a place where you're attending to the other person in a kind of listening, caring way that you can transform the way you've been with people to another way of being with people. Is everybody? If you don't change on that level, it just goes on forever. The system you're working in, it goes on forever. There's no end to it. And finally, you just kind of make something do, you know, oh, well, I guess I'm 35, better have a baby, something maybe. And then you're, you know, you got the stroller in the back. What am I doing here? You know, the barbecue stroller. What the? I don't know, I guess. So please don't let that happen to you. On that note, everyone go home.
she has a question.
Are the lectures recorded?
I think so.
Yes. Ones were available to listen online.
Yes, we'll make them available. So,
what about Jason? Maybe we can get it for you.
Yeah, did you put your name?
Okay.
Sure.
If people want, you can put your name, write down your name and email.
Sure. Okay, goodbye, everybody. We're signing on.
Okay.
Good night. Everybody go home, go rest.